Today is Friday, August 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A heat wave in southern Europe has contributed to the outbreak of wildfires across Europe, but not necessarily their origins.
Authorities say many of the fires were caused by people and have already made some arrests.
Plus, a Belarusian Olympic sprinter defects after her grandmother tells her it isn't safe to return home.
Her case, reminiscent of Cold War sporting defections, could further isolate Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko.
We'll have these stories and more next. A heat wave in southern Europe, fed by strong, hot winds from North Africa, has contributed to the outbreak of wildfires across the Mediterranean, including Italy, Greece, Spain, and Turkey. Firefighters in Italy have been deployed from all regions to battle blazes raging in many areas of the country, destroying thousands of hectares of forests. Sabina Castelfranco starts us off.
The high temperatures in southern Italy have prompted health ministry officials to put some areas of the country on red alert, like Sicily. Fires have been raging on the island and in other parts of Italy for days, with authorities struggling to contain the fast-spreading blazes that have charred thousands of hectares of forests. Authorities deployed thousands of firefighters and water-dropping planes from across Italy. But due to the scale of the fires, the EU has also had to send in resources. In Sardinia, 20,000 hectares of forest were destroyed, forcing hundreds of people to evacuate. The fires damaged farmland and livestock, businesses and homes, and there is concern about losses to the island's biodiversity. Cristian Solinas, president of the Sardinia region, calls the fires an unprecedented disaster. Residents spoke of apocalyptic scenes. In Sicily, fires are still raging in different areas, with the flames having also reached the southern city of Catania on the eastern coast. Here, too, many residents were forced to leave their homes and police had to intervene by sea to save some 200 people stranded at beach resorts because of the fires and heavy smoke. Catania Airport had to temporarily close due to the smoke. Also hard hit is the region of Abruzzo, where flames devoured a pine forest in Pescara on the Adriatic coast, sending tourists and residents to the hospital after inhaling smoke. Authorities say many of the fires were caused by people and have already made some arrests. Speaking on Italian TV, Pescara Mayor Carlo Masci called the events in his area truly dramatic and said those responsible must pay.
Un attacco al cuore della città, al polmone verde di Pescara, la sua tradizione, la sua.
Masci describes it as an attack on the heart of the city, the green lung of Pescara, its tradition, its history, its roots. The mayor says the blazes developed in various parts and the winds fueled the massive flames. He adds that he had never seen anything like this before, and people were practically encircled by the fires. Like in other parts of Italy, Masci said the impact on the local environment was incalculable, with the whole area of the D'Annunziana Reserve, the city's large pine forest, destroyed. He said it hurt to see all those skeletons of the trees. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Belarusian Olympic sprinter Kristina Timanskaya says that she has decided to defect. Reuters' Lauren Anthony is up next.
Don't come back to Belarus. It's not safe for you here. That was the warning Olympian Kristina Szymanowskaja says her grandmother gave to her. The Belarusian sprinter decided to defect from her country as she was being driven to Tokyo Airport. In an exclusive interview with Reuters in the Polish capital Warsaw on Thursday, Szymanowskaja said she decided to heed that warning and that of her parents.
My parents, looking at all this, concluded that upon my return home, I'd either face a psychiatric ward or prison. We know that such situations have happened in our country.
24-year-old Simonovskaya had criticised negligence by her team coaches. She attracted international attention on Sunday when she claimed those coaches, angry at her criticism, had ordered her to fly home from Tokyo.
I said I decided to run 200 metres, and he said OK, and maybe wanted to make a call. And in a couple of hours, the head coach came to me with the team representative, and they said there was a decision made to send me home. He said, we're not the ones who made the decision, but we are only executing it. You have 40 minutes. You have to pack your things and go to the airport.
Simonovskaya sought protection from Japanese airport police. She subsequently spent 2 nights in the Polish embassy in Japan before flying to Poland via Vienna. Poland has granted Simonovskaya and her husband humanitarian visas. Her case, reminiscent of Cold War sporting defections, could further isolate Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko. He is currently under Western sanctions after a crackdown on opponents since last year. Lukashenko's spokesperson did not immediately respond to a request for comment after Simonovskaya's interview. The Belarus National Olympic Committee didn't respond to additional comment requests either.
I am not afraid. I am not one of those people who are scared. I always stand for the truth. I respect myself. I respect my work. And I also want other people to respect themselves, to respect their work, and stop being afraid, and start speaking openly about what worries them.
Despite her current circumstances, Simonovskaya still hopes to go home one day.
I really hope that one day I can return to Belarus. I did not betray my homeland. I love it so much. I hope that one day I will return to my free Belarus.
Before going to Tokyo, Simonovskaya was not among the few Belarusian Olympians who publicly voiced support for the Belarus opposition. Opposition figures have been prosecuted, jailed or fled since mass protests against Lukashenko began last year, even before he won a sixth presidential term in an election that critics say was rigged, something he vehemently denies.
Lauren Anthony of Reuters News. The author of Britain's Chelsea Football Club, Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich, and Russia's state-owned oil giant Rosneft have both filed a defamation lawsuit against the author of a book about President Vladimir Putin's rise to power. Henry Ridgewell reports that activists say the case threatens the freedom of the press.
In her 2020 book, Putin's People, author Catherine Belton wrote that Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich bought the Chelsea Football Club in 2003 on the orders of President Vladimir Putin to extend Russian influence abroad. Abramovich's lawyer told London's High Court that the book contained what he described as lazy inaccuracies, which gave the impression that he was Putin's cashier. Abramovich denies he bought Chelsea on Putin's orders. Author Belton cited two sources for the allegation. One was former Russian government insider Sergei Pugachev, the other anonymous. Defense lawyers told the court that Abramovich's wealth was to a substantial extent on call when requested by President Putin. Press freedom advocates say the courts are being used to silence journalists. Seamus Dooley is the Assistant General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists.
The concern here is that this could lead to, and it's intended indeed, to create a climate of fear, which would inhibit investigative journalism and which would inhibit the questioning of those who exercise huge power and wealth and influence. It's about Russia. It's about Russian money, but it's also about Russian influence in the UK.
Russia's state-owned energy giant Rosneft is also suing Belton and her publisher, HarperCollins UK. Rosneft's lawyers argued passages in the book suggested the company had expropriated the assets of Russian oil company Yukos in a rigged auction. Catherine Belton's lawyers told the court the claims were well-sourced and based on years of research and interviews. As Belton is named as a defendant, her personal assets are at risk. Again, Seamus Dooley of the National Union of Journalists.
We have to be very clear that there is a right to one's good name. There is a right to protect your reputation. But when defamation law is used to prevent, as is happening, it seems to me, in this case, the legitimate questioning of powerful individuals, when it is used to inhibit legitimate questioning about matters of public interest, then we have to ask if the law is appropriate.
Financier and human rights campaigner Bill Browder fears a chilling effect on the media.
You're going to have less robust reporting and less controversial books about corruption in Russia and about Putin and about the oligarchs, because everyone's going to be afraid of finding themselves in the same situation.
Belton's book was name-checked in a video posted online by the jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, in which he claimed President Putin owned a secret $1 billion mansion on the Black Sea. Putin denies the claim. Again, Bill Browder.
I'm certain that the Kremlin will use every aspect of this case as propaganda.
The initial two-day hearing last month was to decide the meaning of contested passages. A ruling on that is expected next month, and any defamation trial would proceed on the basis of those meanings. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. 1 year after the devastating explosion in the port city of Beirut, little progress has been made in the investigation and no accountability has been assigned. As Lebanon flounders under multiple crises, the blast has become a symbol of both defeat and resistance. Jacob Russell has that story.
On the 4th of August, 2020, thousands of tons of improperly stored ammonium nitrate detonated in Beirut's port. The blast killed at least 211 people, injured thousands, and wreaked massive destruction across Beirut. 1 year on, and the official investigation has stalled against what critics say is the wall of impunity that surrounds Lebanon's leadership.
The main obstacle that the investigation is currently facing is the problem of immunities and of lifting immunities on senior officials and on senior public servants as well.
The chemical arrived in the port in 2013, and this week a Human Rights Watch report detailed what it said was gross negligence and failure to act since then at every level of authority. The Prime Minister's office called the report faulty and said he had done all within his power to address the issue. The blast and the search for answers has come to represent the wider struggle against corruption and government incompetence in Lebanon.
Now we feel that we are all victims with the victims of the blast, and that the perpetrator is one. It is that criminal regime which has collapsed our economy, stolen our savings, stolen our parents' pension funds, and also blasted our capital and our homes.
On Wednesday, relatives of victims gathered with demonstrators to mark the anniversary and demand justice.
If the national investigation will lead to nothing because our deputies are not lifting immunities, we ask the international community to help us with an international investigation so that they will punish those who did this to my son. My son deserved to live. He was full of life, full of ambition.
Afterwards, they marched towards the parliament, where violence broke out as some protesters faced off against security forces using tear gas and rubber bullets. As they endure profound hardships brought on by decades of incompetent leadership, many in Lebanon have pinned high hopes on this investigation. Hopes that finally, somebody might be held to account. Jacob Russell for VOA News, Beirut.
Ibrahim Raisi, who is the protege of Iran's supreme leader, has been sworn in as the country's new president. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas has this story.
An orchestra plays to mark a new chapter in Iran during a ceremony in parliament. Raisi, the former judiciary chief known for his distrust of the West, takes the reins at a tense time. The country is going through crippling sanctions as talks to salvage its 2015 nuclear deal have stalled. In his address, Raisi stressed his embrace of diplomacy to lift U.S. sanctions. He also said he would mend rifts with neighbors, a subtle reference to Sunni rival Saudi Arabia. However, the newly inaugurated president also stated Iran's desire to expand its power as a counterbalance to foes across the region. UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab says the inauguration could create a new start for Iran.
There's a new president that's inaugurated this week, and there's a crossroads set of opportunities.
I'm Karen Chamas.
Russia begins mass military exercises with its Central Asian allies, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, near the Chadik border with Afghanistan this week. The maneuvers come against the backdrop of a U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and rapid territorial gains by its adversaries in the Afghan Taliban. Charles Maines takes it from here.
With the U.S. finalizing its withdrawal from Afghanistan, Russia is taking a two-track approach towards the region. On the one hand, diplomacy, with Russia's foreign ministry holding repeated talks with Taliban representatives in a bid for influence. On the other, a show of force, with Russia's military joining Central Asian allies to confront a possible crisis in the making, say analysts.
It's good that the Americans are out, and it's bad that the Americans are out at the same time. It's an opportunity. At the same time, it's a very grave threat to vital Russian interests.
The Kremlin is openly worried that renewed fighting could destabilize Central Asia, a region traditionally under Moscow's sway. Observers say the military may not be the best defense against the prospect of tens of thousands of refugees streaming across the border and spreading Islamic extremism into a region known for weak autocratic governments, poverty, and corruption.
Attacks against extremists are pointless. They're only there to show that Russia's political power in the region has always been and will always be. But a different and more controversial question is what kind of Taliban might be coming to power.
Russia has long maintained a large base near the Afghan border in Tajikistan. And Moscow says it's ready to come to allies' aid under a collective security agreement if necessary. Officially, Russia still designates the Taliban a terrorist organization. But having fought its own deadly decade-long war in Afghanistan in the 1980s that ended in withdrawal, few think the Kremlin is eager to engage again militarily. But ignoring the Afghan issue is also not an option.
Russia has lots to lose. America can walk away from Afghanistan and forget it as a bad dream. They have that privilege. Russia cannot.
As the American role in Afghanistan comes to a close, some in Moscow say the U.S. has been forced to learn the Soviet lesson of the limits of empire. Yet the fast-changing circumstances on the ground offer few guarantees for what comes next. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
The Taliban have stepped up their efforts to defeat Afghanistan government forces, taking control of more than half of the country's districts and some border crossings. Now, the group tells Reuters they're changing their strategy from targeting rural areas to attacking provincial cities. This is in response to increased U.S. airstrikes to counter Taliban offensives. The recent Taliban attacks have stretched Afghan special forces thin and have killed many civilians. U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday offered an 18-month safe haven to thousands of Hong Kong residents to remain living in the U.S. rather than face repression by being deported to the Chinese-controlled territory. Biden assailed Beijing's 14-month crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong and said it was compelling U.S. foreign policy interests to allow Hong Kong residents to stay and work in the U.S. In northern Burkina Faso, militants have killed at least 30 people, including members of the military. The government says the dead include 11 civilians, 15 soldiers, and 4 volunteer defense fighters outside the town of Markoye near the Niger border. Officials say at least 10 militants were killed, and the army has now secured the area. The U.S. Justice Department said on Thursday that it has returned an additional $452 million stolen from Malaysia's investment fund known as the One Malaysia Development Berhad, or 1MDB, bringing the total amount of money repatriated to the Malaysian government in the last 5 years to at least $1.2 billion.
This is Science in a Minute.
In
May 2019, a team of astronomers led by the University of Colorado Boulder was watching our closest stellar neighbor, Proxima Centauri, when they happened to spot the most violent stellar flare ever recorded from this low-mass red dwarf. The scientists used 9 telescopes to study the star, which allowed them to observe it at various wavelengths across the electromagnetic spectrum. The astronomers have analyzed their observational data and have now released a study in the astrophysical journal Letters that details their finding. Proxima Centauri is only 4.2 light years away and is one of the 3 stars that make up the Alpha Centauri system. While a stellar flare similar to our sun's solar flares only lasted 7 seconds, the astronomers found that it was about 100 times more powerful than any from our sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Australia continues to struggle against the Delta variant of the coronavirus, with its largest city of Sydney reporting a record daily number of new cases and the state of Victoria announcing a 1-week lockdown. Sydney, which is near the 7th week of a 9-week lockdown, reported 262 cases and 5 deaths during the past 24 hours. So far, the country has seen relatively few cases and deaths, but vaccination rates are low, with only about 20% of the people over 16 fully vaccinated. As the COVID-19 Delta variant sweeps through the southern U.S. states, which have low vaccination rates as well, doctors with the Infectious Disease Society of America are calling for more testing and more vaccinations, both in the U.S. and in other countries as well. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
The Delta variant was first detected in India, but it's rapidly spreading around the world. In the U.S., it's fueling at least 80% of new outbreaks, mainly among those who are not vaccinated. The variant can affect even those who have received the COVID-19 vaccine. Dr. Ricardo Franco says the Delta variant makes up an even higher number of new COVID infections at the University of Alabama Hospital. He put the number there at 89%. He added that nearly all patients at his hospital are not vaccinated against the virus.
The key here is that the overwhelming majority of infections are occurring among the unvaccinated. Data from COVID Tracker shows that a vaccinated person is 8 times less likely to get infected by the Delta variant compared to an unvaccinated person. It is 25 times less likely to be hospitalized, and if hospitalized, 25 times less likely to die from COVID-19.
Franco cited the New York Times COVID tracker that shows case rates in low vaccination areas are higher than in areas of high vaccination.
The conclusion here is that vaccination is working through this Delta wave. And more importantly, unvaccinated people are actually benefiting from greater herd immunity protection in high vaccination counties compared to low vaccination ones.
Franco said herd immunity should increase as more people get vaccinated. But there's a problem with the data because fewer tests are being performed and many testing centers in the U.S. have closed. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel from the University of Pennsylvania said without testing, it's hard to know where the variant is spreading and who is spreading it.
And so we really don't have a good handle on the frequency of asymptomatic, but nevertheless apparently transmissible infections with Delta.
Emanuel said that without widespread testing, new variants will be missed both in the U.S. and elsewhere.
We have to stop being U.S. focused alone because these variants, you know, in the case of Delta, arose overseas and came here. And so getting the world vaccinated is a top priority and has to be a top priority. We don't know where a new one is going to evolve.
Until the virus is stopped, Emmanuel said the best protection is wearing a mask at public places indoors and even outdoors in large crowds. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
A World Bank UN Refugee Agency survey in 8 developing countries finds that the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic has worsened conditions for forcibly displaced people, pushing them to take extreme measures to survive. The data was collected from 90,000 phone interviews in Bangladesh, Chad, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Iraq, Kenya, Uganda, and Yemen. Lisa Schlein has the details.
An analysis of the data shows forcibly displaced people and the communities hosting them are suffering from the social and economic fallout of the pandemic. However, it finds displaced people are at particular risk from the pandemic, which has increased their vulnerabilities in significant, life-threatening ways. The survey highlights the devastating and wide-reaching impacts on the forcibly displaced from government lockdowns. It says they are faced with increased food prices, loss of jobs and income, lack of health care, school closures, and limited freedom of movement. Jeffrey Tanner is senior economist of the World Bank UNHCR Joint Data Center on Forced Displacement. He says families who have been forced to flee their homes due to violence and persecution are at renewed risk of losing their livelihoods.
For example, we see that 9 in 10 refugees in Uganda and 3 in 4 refugees in Chad reported that their total income had decreased since the pandemic. These households have two sources of income: what they earn and what they receive through assistance. They experienced employment losses at rates at least as large, if not larger, than hosts.
This loss of income, he says, means displaced people have difficulty paying for food, housing, medical care, and education for their children. Tanner says food insecurity is a huge problem in all countries surveyed.
Forcibly displaced households across Bangladesh, Chad, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Iraq, Kenya, and Uganda reported reducing their food or non-food consumption, or both. In Kenya, for example, adults in half of refugee households are skipping meals so that their children have food to eat. And more than 75% of refugee households decrease the number of meals that they eat every day.
Authors of the survey note forcibly displaced people rarely are represented in national statistics. They say the continued collection of such data will allow humanitarian and development agencies to target their support to vulnerable groups in ways it will do the most good. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And finally, small self-navigating drones designed to think and move like bees could revolutionize the future of agriculture, search and rescue missions, and even more. VOA's Julie Tabo gives us this exclusive look behind the scenes.
Small autonomous drones that can fly and navigate like bees are the vision of the future for a team of researchers at the University of Maryland. Yanis Alimonos is a professor at the Department of Computer Science at the university, where he heads the project.
They are very small flying mechanisms that are equipped with cameras, sensors, and computer. And they are able to perceive the world, think about it, make decisions, and act accordingly.
Yeah, I think we should make the drone a little bit smaller.
Soon, these self-navigating drones will be able to help pollinate flowers or work in environments that are dangerous for humans.
When this technology reaches the market, it will be very useful, you know, for dealing with search and rescue operations in terms of earthquakes, with inspections of bridges, with agriculture.
The drones are not controlled by a human with a joystick, but instead they use computer vision to see obstacles in their path and artificial intelligence to determine the best way around or through them. They've been designed to mimic the behavior of birds and bees to move and navigate through small openings. And they'll be launched in the field from a larger drone designed like a beehive to perform a multitude of tasks. Nitin Sanket is a doctoral candidate in Professor Yanis's group.
These drones open up a world of possibilities because if you want to deploy 1,000 drones, which are large, you want 1,000 operators, right? With these smaller ones, you just have a big drone and it carries 1,000 of these and goes to a point and it will just deploy it automatically.
The bee drones can travel more than 6 kilometers round trip. And while there are concerns about the potential misuse of these little machines, for now, the team is focusing on all the good they can be capable of. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.